My name is Al Whitney. Welcome to In Defense of Humanity on this 12th day of August, 2017. This program is about helping people reawaken to the wonderful qualities of our own species while accepting and understanding that the current corporate commercial legal structure, both government and business is built upon, is actively seeking to take control of most organic life forms on our planet. Restoring our unalienable rights and preserving our planet will require that we, the people, understand what has happened and learn how to empower ourselves as living men and women. Much of the information discussed on this show can be found on my website, anticorruptionsociety.com. If you need to remind yourself why humanity is worth defending, please read and enjoy the In Defense of Humanity page listed at the top of my home website. I'd like to make new listeners aware that there's a free People's Empowerment Guide to our corporate commercial legal system on my website called Lawfully Yours. It is a collaboration of many men and women in the legal accountability movement. You can locate it by clicking on the Lawfully Yours tab at the top on my homepage. Our guide has been viewed more than 60,000 times since it was posted 2.5 years ago, and it's now in its 9th edition. We keep adding to it as more info and ideas come to our attention. This guide contains valuable strategies for challenging the non-existent authority of our corporate government. Tonight, I would like to talk about why the Constitution had to be destroyed. I ran into a wonderful source this past week. The gentleman's name is Thomas DiLorenzo. Thomas DiLorenzo. And I listened to several of YouTubes that were up. They were presentations that he gave at the Mises Institute. The one that really caught my attention was one that he did on January 14th, 2012. And if you want to see it for yourself, which I highly recommend you do, it's only 42 minutes. Just type in your search box, YouTube- why the Constitution had to be destroyed. It gave me a whole new outlook. Much of the information I was aware of, and probably many of the listeners are aware of, but I hadn't quite put it into the same perspective that he had. We kind of watched as the Constitution seems to be on hold, and we still somehow think if we put somebody in office, things will change. But the battle between a powerful federal government and independent sovereign state governments started almost immediately with the passage of the Constitution and the Articles of Confederation. and was ongoing for many, many years until finally the centralist or the federalist or the nationalist, the guys in D.C., won out. And this has gone on for a long time. Judge Napolitano talks about how the Constitution's in exile. So I thought I would pull out a few clips from this. I don't want to play all 42 minutes. And let people hear what his research has made him aware of, and he's sharing with us. Now, there is an article that I found, and people can read this as well, because this kind of says what he's saying on the presentation. This article is on lewrockwell.com, and the name of the article is "Back When There Were Three Branches of Government, Not to Mention the States Respectively or the People." And he pretty much describes, and it's not very long, and it's really quite well written. This guy is a professor of economics at Loyola University, Maryland, and he's written several books. He also has just a truckload full of articles on lewrockwell.com, and you can find a lot of his YouTube talks on YouTube. They're just, I think I found five so far, and they're all excellent. I'm not sure that I personally agree with everything that the Mises Institute has concluded. And I have some misgivings about Austrian economics. I know Ron Paul is big on that. And that a lot of probably RBN listeners are big Ron Paul fans, but I am too. I'm just thinking I'm not completely sold that the answer is Austrian economics, but I certainly would agree that what we've got now is basically economic warfare against the people of the United States, pretty much economic warfare against the general public everywhere. So let's start with these. I have about six clips of this talk that was given in January 2012 of Thomas DiLorenzo. Can we play the first clip?
So the nationalists to this day refer to that as saying, well, it does say we the people, so didn't the Constitution create a government created by the whole people? Well, no, the original version of the Constitution, in the original version, the preamble said this: "We the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Providence, Plantations, Connecticut," named all the states individually, until somebody said, well, wait a minute, we don't know that every state is going to ratify. Why? How can we put in the document every state listed? What if Connecticut says no thanks? They shouldn't be listed in the document. They're not a part of the United States. So they just left it as we the people. That's what actually happened. And it's been lied about ever since. But of course, Madison himself, James Madison, in the Federalist Papers, number 39, explained how the Constitution is to be ratified, not by the whole people. He says, it says this: not as individuals composing one entire nation, but as composing the distinct and independent states to which they respectively belong. And so it doesn't take a lot of searching to find out how the Constitution was ratified. Daniel Webster was another one, a famous nationalist, who carried this argument further. And he, of course, he was in a famous debate over the nature of the Union with Robert Hayne, Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina, in 1830. And he says this: "The Constitution of the United States confers on the government itself the power of deciding ultimately and conclusively upon the extent of its own authority." So could you imagine that the Founding Fathers would have given the government in Washington, it wasn't even Washington at the time, the central government, the exclusive power to decide the limits of its own powers? And of course, they all understood that if they did that, they would soon decide that there are no limits to its powers, which, of course, is where we are now. But that wasn't the original design. This is just a lie.
Okay, I don't think that was clip number one, but we'll try to move along. Sam, do you have clip number one? Okay, I guess he was out of...
The title I gave the Mises Institute was Why the Constitution Had to Be Destroyed. That was many months ago, but I think I should have added a subtitle of And How They Did It. And that's going to be the bulk of my talk, and how they did it. And of course, the Constitution has been effectively destroyed. There really are no constitutional limits on the growth of government anymore. Judge Andrew Napolitano, in his book, The Constitution in Exile, noted that not a single federal law was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court from 1937 to 1995. So every once in a blue moon, you'll see the Supreme Court ruling in favor of the people and against the Washington establishment. But maybe not even a full moon. Every once a century now is the way it is. So essentially, we live in a regime of unlimited government. The only time Republicans ever really, apart from Ron Paul, ever talk about the Constitution is whenever they want to use it to block something the Democrats are trying to do. And the only time you ever hear a Democrat in Congress talking about the Constitution is when they want to try to use it to block something the Republicans are trying to do at the moment. But nobody believes in using it as a limit on governmental power, with the exception of Ron Paul and a few others. In fact, 5 or 6 years ago, Congressman Paul invited me to speak to his Liberty Caucus in Washington in his office. It was about 10 or 11 members of Congress who were like-minded. And in some of the names would be familiar to most of you, I suppose. And one of the things these members of Congress all nodded their heads to was when one of them said, "You can no longer be taken seriously in Congress if you make constitutional arguments against any governmental program." And so our rulers understand this. They've won. They've succeeded. And so I thought it would be useful to try to tell the story of how this came about. And why the Constitution had to be destroyed, based on some of my research in economic history. And I'm going to just read you the answer. This is why the Constitution had to be destroyed, in my opinion. So I guess I can sit down after I read this this paragraph here. This was a statement by the late Murray Rothbard in one of his books about the very beginning of the American Republic. About the very, very beginning of the American Republic, there always were the two factions in American politics. You had the nationalists who wanted a powerful central government that would be very active and do all sorts of bad things. And then you had the Jeffersonian wing, the decentralists who wanted limited decentralized government, limited taxation, and so forth. And, you know, throughout the whole history of the country, we've had a back and forth battle between the nationalists and the centralizers on the one hand, and the decentralizers and the more libertarian wing of American politics on the other. And here is how Rothbard described the nationalists. And, of course, Alexander Hamilton has always been looked at as the intellectual leader of the so-called nationalists of that time. What were they about? What did they want at the beginning of the Republic when the American Revolution ended? Here's what they wanted, according to Rothbard. They wanted, quote, I'm quoting, to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. The strong government was to impose high tariffs to subsidize domestic manufacturers, develop a big navy to open up and subsidize foreign markets for American exports, and launch a massive system of internal public works. In short, the United States was to have a British system without Great Britain. That's Murray Rothbard. And Alexander Hamilton actually labeled this system the American system. How's that for Orwellian double talk? He wanted a clone of the British mercantilist system that the Revolution had just been fought against, and they wanted to call it the American system. And so if you break this down, what did they want? A centralized state where political power was totally centered in the federal government, heavy federal taxes and debts, discriminatory taxes. High tariff would be a discriminatory tax, and the original Constitution prohibited discriminatory taxation altogether. They wanted corporate welfare run amok, essentially, and aggressive militarism. Does any of that sound familiar to anybody? Could you? What country might you describe that is characterized today by these things that you might be familiar with? Of course, that's our system today. And so I'm going to argue that that was why the Constitution had to be destroyed, because the Constitution did not, neither did the Articles of Confederation, certainly create a highly centralized state with heavy federal taxes and debt, discriminatory taxes, corporate welfare run amok, and aggressive militarism. That was not the system. So a very long, decades-long campaign or crusade had to be waged in a lot of different areas, in the courts, in politics, and elsewhere, to destroy the Constitution so that this would be allowed, so that this would come into being. And at the beginning of the American Republic, the proponents of this, of course, were the Hamiltonians, Hamilton himself, people such as Chief Justice John Marshall, Justice Joseph Story, Supreme Court Justice, Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, and Abraham Lincoln. Those were the nationalists up until the Civil War era. The opponents of all this were the Jeffersonians, Jefferson himself, Madison, Monroe, Andrew Jackson, President John Tyler, and people of that sort. And there was a very large battle that went on. Okay, and so you have to understand a little bit of the history of this, in that Hamilton himself, when he attended the Constitutional Convention, he did propose a permanent president who would appoint all the governors. So this was the first salvo in this decade-long political battle to essentially achieve a centralized monopolistic state. And the centralized monopolistic state was always tied to an economic agenda. It was tied to that economic agenda that I just mentioned, the so-called American system. And so that's what Hamilton did. He laid out his plan of a permanent president who would appoint all the governors, who would have veto power over all state legislation. And that would have been identical to England. They just fought a revolution against that. And of course, they didn't win. They didn't win that. And there was a senator from Virginia at the time named John Taylor, who smoked these people out. He wrote a great little book that has recently been republished, and is based on the notes taken at the Constitutional Convention by Robert Yates, who was the Chief Justice of New York at the time, who attended the Constitutional Convention. You know, these men swore to secrecy at the Constitutional Convention, and that should have been a big giant rat. For those of you familiar with labor union antics, you might know that whenever there's a company that is bidding for a contract and is using non-union labor, labor unions often show up with a pickup truck with a gigantic inflated rat in the back of the pickup truck that's about 30 feet high. I don't know if you've ever seen this, because they call the non-union workers rats. That should have been sitting outside of the convention hall in Philadelphia when they worked up the Constitution, because they swore themselves to secrecy. And, you know, whenever you get a bunch of politicians in a room swearing themselves to secrecy, you know you should smell a big fat rat. And so, but the rat was exposed maybe 20 or 30 years after the actual event, in the form of James Madison's notes, which were eventually published, and also the notes by Robert Yates, who his wife published after his death in the 1820s. But here's what Senator John Taylor of Virginia said about what was going on at the time. He said, what was being proposed was a national government nearly conforming to that of England. By Colonel Hamilton's project, the states were fairly and openly to be restored to the rank of provinces and to be made as dependent upon a supreme national government as they had been upon a supreme British government. And so the Jeffersonians were saying, wait a minute, we just fought a revolution against this system. Why would we want this? And, of course, the reason why they wanted it is the same reason why the King of England wanted it. He enriched himself and his friends with it at the expense of everybody else, but it was a way to enrich the politically connected and the elite, who supported the government. And, of course, when Hamilton and his cronies did not get their way, Hamilton himself denounced the Constitution as a frail and worthless fabric. Here's another thing that John Taylor noted in his book. He said, the convention attendees viewed the Constitution as a compact among the free and independent states and not the creation of a national government. It was proposed and seconded to erase the word national, so somebody did propose this, and substitute the words United States in the plural in the fourth resolution, which passed in the affirmative. Thus, we see an opinion expressed at the Constitutional Convention that the phrase, quote, United States, did not mean a consolidated American people or nation, and all the inferences in favor of a national government are overthrown. In all the founding documents, by the way, the words United States are always in the plural, meaning the free, independent, and sovereign states are united in creating a compact or a confederacy to achieve certain ends. There was no such idea of something called the United States government, the monolithic Leviathan that exists in Washington, D.C. today. So Taylor also, as I said, smoked these people out in terms of their economic agenda. He said their intent was to create, and I'm quoting again, quote, monarchy and its handmaiden consolidation and its other handmaiden ambition and a national government dressed up in popular guises such as national splendor and national strength. So these were the original neocons.
Extendivite is more than just a heart tonic. Most basic diseases are caused by yeast in the gut and metals in the liver, and we all have a bit of both. The garlic in Extendivite has a yeast-killing effect in the gut while also helping the sulfur enzyme in the liver get rid of the metals. Extendivite just may improve your overall health. Products like Extendivite are the only way we are going to get our society healthy. And if you're waiting for the government and pharmaceutical care to solve your health problems, you're going to have a long, disappointing wait, I think. Extendivite is a complete formula for extended life in the new millennium. 80 can be the new 60. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a two-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Nutramedicals Power C Plus is the greatest important breakthrough in vitamin C technology since Linus Pauling. It is the only neutral pH vitamin C in the world as a calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium ascorbate salt with bioperin, a black pepper extract, to increase absorption by 40%. When you take Power C Plus, it helps to alkalinize all the cells of your body instantly, raise the oxygen level and energetic level of cells, suppress cancer and inflammation in your body, and help you fight infections. Power C Plus also helps to build up the collagen in your body, hyaluronic acid in your joints, and the glycosaminoglycans in your joints, as well as to improve healing of any tissue in your body. Power C Plus is very unique at NutriMedical.com. That's NutriMedical.com, where you can order, or 888-212-8871. That's NutriMedical, NutriMedical.com.
Defense of humanity. I thought that was really interesting. I had no idea. I don't know. A lot of people were probably familiar with the fact there was this debate, states' rights versus federal power, going on right in the very beginning. And I guess I haven't read the Federalist Papers, and I haven't looked that far back in history. But what I found particularly interesting was the date 1937, that since from 1937, according to Judge Napolitano, to 1995, the Supreme Court did not find anything that Congress was doing unconstitutional. And we've talked about this on this show, what happened in 1944 with mandatory vaccines. That Supreme Court decision still sits. It is still in place. It was just cited last year when some attorneys in California were challenging the mandatory vaccine bill that passed, SB 277, which eliminated philosophical exemptions. There was a lawsuit, and a Judge Sobrow came back with his response, and he cited the three Supreme Court decisions that would be supportive of the government forcing children to be vaccinated. And the Prince was done in 1944, that decision. And in that decision is when the Supreme Court justices decided to bring in the term parents patriae and bring in the general welfare of the community. And the state, as parents patriae, then has a right for the general welfare to mandate these children get vaccinations, which at the time I read that several years ago, I kept thinking, this can't be constitutional. You know, freedom of religion and freedom of, it just didn't make sense. And it's starting to make sense now when I'm listening to this gentleman talk about how the Constitution over these many years has literally been neutralized. I don't think most Americans know about that conversation that Ron Paul and those in Congress who were supportive of Ron Paul had with Thomas DiLorenzo, where they are admitting they can't bring up the Constitution in any argument when they're discussing or debating new legislation. That's startling. That should startle all of us. Why is it that they can't bring up the Constitution? Well, Thomas DiLorenzo did not mention the permanent state of national emergency. I have seen about five of his videos, and I don't think I've located any sign that he's aware of Senate Report 93549, whereby the constitutional government was put on hold, suspended during a state of national emergency, and the Senate report that came out in 1973 exposes that very fact, and this state of emergency has been in place since 1933. So as long as we're in a state of emergency, I imagine that no one in Congress nor are the Supreme Courts going to bring back constitutional rights or states' rights. We are now in a war on terror. And what they're doing is they're militarizing our police. I see no sign of them relinquishing their power. I see them expanding it. I think most of the RBN listeners see that as well. So in 1937, there was a Supreme Court decision. Apparently, when the New Deal kicked up quite a bit of fuss, and I did a search, and the listeners are welcome to do this search. The search that I did was on New Deal-Constitution, because, of course, it was Roosevelt that brought in the state of emergency. It was Roosevelt that brought in the confiscation of the people's gold. It was Roosevelt that brought in the Social Security Act. These were all under the New Deal. And one of the articles I read indicated that there were Supreme Court justices in 1935, challenging the Social Security Act. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at libertystickers.com. Again, that's libertystickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain, and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone, and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's A-N-G-I-O-P-R-I-M.com. Or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll-free at 877-882-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
This is Al Whitney, and tonight we are listening to clips from a talk that was given at the Mises Institute by economist and author Thomas DiLorenzo. Before we take the next clip, I wanted to mention that apparently there were justices in 1935 that were not happy with the New Deal and felt it was violating the Constitution. And again, if you do your search and you put New Deal-Constitution, Roosevelt tried to stack the Supreme Court and actually succeeded in altering the justices sitting on the bench, so to speak. And so by 1937, they absolutely withdrew any concern about it, the Social Security Act being unconstitutional, and claimed that it was. 1937 is also the year of Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, where the federal courts stopped hearing common law cases. So it's really quite interesting when you put together what FDR actually did and how much that changed our government, but the obviously the groundwork had been laid many, many years prior. So let's hear the next clip, if we could. Number two.
No, Taylor also knew, he understood, and that wasn't just John Taylor, it was all the Jeffersonians. They understood that this push for a monopoly government where all power is centered in the nation's capital was always tied to the economic agenda. And the economic agenda is sort of an example of early day Krugmanisms. In other words, it was convoluted, ass-backwards economics of the sort that you would read in a typical Paul Krugman New York Times column. Here's what John Taylor wrote in 1823 about what these people were up to. He's mocking their economic arguments. He's saying, here's what they're saying. They're saying this, quote, I'm quoting John Taylor, the greater the government revenue, the richer are the people. So the more they tax you, the richer you are. So that frugality in the government is an evil thing. But in the people, it's a good thing. So the more of your money you give the government, and the more you let the government spend, that's a good thing. That monopolies and exclusive privileges promote the general welfare. That a division of sovereignty will raise up a class of wicked, intriguing, self-interested politicians in the states. But that human nature will be cleansed of these propensities by a sovereignty consolidated in one government in the nation's capital. So the state politicians are wicked and evil, but the ones in the faraway capital where the citizens have no control over, they're saints. That's what he was right about every part of this. And you have to understand that the battle over the Constitution at the time was between Jefferson, who saw the document as something that would bind government in chains. Their famous phrase was, government needs to be bound by the chains of the Constitution. The Hamiltonians, totally the opposite. They saw this document as, if it was properly interpreted by clever lawyers like themselves, as a potential rubber stamp on anything the government would ever do. As long as you could get enough government judges on the Supreme Court who are like-minded to go along with rubber stamping everything, then it could be a useful document. And one of the historians of Hamilton, a biographer of Hamilton, said this of him. He said, it seems certain that Hamilton, had he had his way, would have affixed a certain certificate of constitutionality to every last tax. Hamilton took a large view of the power of Congress to tax because he took a large view of the power to spend. And that, of course, is where we are today. That statistic I mentioned from Judge Napolitano, that the Supreme Court did not declare a single law of any kind unconstitutional from 1937 to 1995, that's the Hamiltonian system, rubber stamp, big government. And Clinton Rossiter, the biographer of Hamilton, said this of him. He said, having failed to persuade his colleagues at the Philadelphia Convention of the beauties of a truly national plan of government, and he's not being sarcastic, Rossiter was a Hamiltonian, and having thereafter recognized the futility of persuading the legislatures of three-fourths of the states to surrender even a jot of their privileges, he set out to remold the Constitution into an instrument of national supremacy. So in other words, as soon as they lost the political battle at the Constitutional Convention, they set out to reinterpret the Constitution so that the proper interpretation would be that it had created a highly centralized government with dictatorial powers, with heavy taxes, heavy debt, corporate welfare, aggressive militarism, and all these things that the nationalists always wanted. So through subterfuge, through lawyerly subterfuge, they set out to reframe the Constitution. And of course, they succeeded. Now, how did they go about doing this? Well, one of the first things that was done was Hamilton himself started rewriting the history of the American founding by saying that the states were, in 1787, he said this, the states were merely artificial beings and were never sovereign. He said the nation, not the states, was sovereign. And so, the way in which the Constitution was adopted was each state held a political convention, and they voted up or down to ratify or not. If you ever read Article 7 of the U.S. Constitution, it explains how the Constitution is to become the law of the land. The states would ratify and go in or out. And, of course, there were several states, like Rhode Island and North Carolina, that stayed out after the Constitution was actually in effect for a year, year and a half, and it took them a while to change their mind. And during that time, there was no proposal that I know of, or that anybody knows of, I think, to invade New England, Rhode Island, bomb Providence and Newport into a smoldering ruins and murder their citizens by the thousands and sing the battle hymn of the Republic while they're doing it. It was seen as being a voluntary union, not a union that as Murray Rothbard once described it, as a Venus flytrap from which there would never be any escape. That was not the idea. They had just fought a revolution against that kind of system in their minds. And so Hamilton invented the lie that the states were never sovereign. And then he invented the myth of implied powers of the Constitution. And that really was the beginning of the end, wasn't it? When you had the Secretary of the Treasury, someone in that kind of a position, the sort of early day Goldman Sachs former CEO type thing. That's really not an exaggeration. The way in which Hamilton became the first Treasury Secretary is described in this Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Hamilton by Ron Chernow. And he knew really nearly nothing about economics or finance. But at the very end of the revolution, he knew that some very influential and wealthy people in Philadelphia who wanted to essentially run the government. And so he wrote them letters and pretty much saying, I agree with you that we need a centralized government with a central bank modeled after the Bank of England and high protective tariffs and subsidies for corporations, pretty much. And these people got him put in as Secretary of Treasury. They wrote George Washington and recommended Hamilton. So he really was sort of the water carrier for the Goldman Sachs of the day. As Treasury Secretary, even though he admittedly knew next to nothing about finance himself. So he invented the idea of implied powers. He also was the first to invent the expansive interpretations of the general welfare and commerce clauses of the Constitution to interpret the general welfare clause to mean just about anything the government would ever do. And so it was Hamilton who really laid the template for how to destroy the Constitution. And he had a lot of devoted followers, the most important of which right after him was John Marshall, the Chief Justice from, he was appointed at the very, very end of the Adams administration. Jefferson became president in March of 1801, and John Marshall became Chief Justice for, I think, 36 years. And he was very, very devoted to the Hamiltonian agenda. And I guess he's most closely associated with the famous Marbury versus Madison decision that planted into place the idea of judicial review of federal legislation. The Constitution makes no mention of this. There's no judicial review in the Constitution. This was John Marshall's idea that he, John Marshall, should be the final arbiter of what is and is not constitutional. And he got away with it. Okay. And so, but Jefferson himself, here's what Jefferson said about this. He says, when he was asked about it, he said, this was in 1819, Thomas Jefferson said, well, my construction or my understanding of the Constitution is that each department, that is each branch of government, is truly independent of the others. And he's saying, wait a minute, we have three branches of government, not one, and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its action. So the Jeffersonian view was that, okay, the Supreme Court can tell us their opinion, but their opinion is no more important than the opinion of the President or the Congress or the people of the states. Jefferson considered the Tenth Amendment to be the cornerstone of the entire document of the Constitution, and that means the powers that are not delegated to the federal government are all reserved to the people in the states respectively, and they should also have an equal say on what is and is not constitutional. The Jeffersonians thought it was insanity to allow everyone's liberty to be in the hands of five government lawyers given lifetime tenure. Well, they have fought a revolution in the name of liberty and then put everybody's liberty in the hands of five government lawyers with lifetime tenure. That's the system we have. That's the nationalist argument, and it's a system we have now. But that was never the intent.
I just think that's amazing. I mean, that is exactly what's going on. I had no idea how it came to pass that the Supreme Court had usurped everyone else's opinion of what is constitutional and what is not. Going back to Prince versus Massachusetts, I'm not sure that even today people don't agree with the general welfare clause, whereby they're saying the state, and they use the term state as if it's one state, the state, has the authority for the sake of the general welfare of the community, again, to force or to mandate that children get vaccinated. It's just astounding to me how this whole thing played out. And this idea, the general welfare and commerce, again, this is coming from these lawyers. And we've done a show on Fred Waddell's book, Woe Unto You Lawyers. And we played a couple clips from a reading of that book, which you can get it for free online. It's just amazing. What a guy, you know, and he wrote it in 1937. And he made note of the New Deal, and he also said how strange that one day Supreme Court justices called something unconstitutional, and my gosh, the next day it became constitutional. He challenged in that book back in 1937, who gave these seven guys in a robe the authority to make these decisions? And again, I'm just sitting here saying, at what point did we turn over the whole country to the lawyers? And that seems to be where we're at today. The lawyers are writing legislation. The lawyers run for office. The lawyers are sitting in our courtrooms. They're making decisions on whether or not you go to jail, whether or not you have to do this, whether or not you have to do that. Lawyers are deciding what's constitutional, what's not. They're writing these contracts that we sign when we get a mortgage. They're writing these agreements that the hospitals have you sign, these consent forms. So really, when the whole country, what we cannot do and can do is based on the opinion of a bunch of lawyers, I'd say that we're going to have to change that. We're going to have to expose it. I don't think they're going to go quietly into the night, however. Let's start the next clip, and we'll just let it run, and you can pause it on the break. Would that be okay?
And so what did Marshall do? Well, one of the things is, I'll give you a few examples of some of the other bad things Marshall did. In a case called Martin versus Hunter's Leasee, Marshall invented out of thin air the notion that the federal government had the right to veto state court decisions. So the federal government essentially took over state court decisions. He also invented out of thin air the idea that the so-called supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution makes the federal government supreme over everything the local, state and local governments do. It did not. All it did was to say that those things that are in Article 1, Section 8, those are the prerogatives of the federal government. The federal government is supreme only in those things. Everything else is left up to the states and the people, respectively, under the 10th Amendment. But the nationalists have always used this word supremacy and supreme law of the land out of context. They have argued that, well, this gives us sort of a Soviet-style government, centralized government, not an American-style government. But John Taylor, again, he wrote about this in his book based on Robert Bates's notes on the Constitutional Convention. He said this: the expression in the Constitution, quote, shall be the supreme law of the land, unquote, is restricted by its limitations and reservations and did not convey any species of supremacy to the government going beyond the powers delegated or those reserved. So it was only those primarily foreign policy and war-making powers that are in Article 1, Section 8 that applies. Marshall repeated the bogus theory of the American founding, claiming that somehow the whole people of the country were involved in it, and it was not done by the individual states. Well, just on the face of it, women did not have the right to vote, and of course the slaves didn't have anything to do with it, and free blacks didn't have the right to vote at the time. And so you could hardly say that the whole country had anything to do with the Constitution, and they certainly did not. But here's what Marshall, he said, in the name of the people, the federal government claimed the right to legitimately control all individuals or governments within the American territory. Think about that. Here's the Chief Justice saying the federal government of Washington can legitimately control all individuals, everything you do, and all governments within the American territory. That was a totalitarian statement, if ever there was one, and that was John Marshall. That's why there's a very good book that ranks the presidents called Recarving Rushmore by Ivan Eland, published by the Independent Institute, and it ranks the presidents. You know, the historians who write these books that rank presidents, they usually have at the top whatever president is involved in killing the most people, blowing up the most buildings, and spending the most money. That's why FDR, Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, they're always way up there at the top. But Ivan Eland took a unique approach, and he said, well, which presidents did the best job in defending the constitutional liberties of Americans? Let's rank them according to that. And he puts John Adams way down near the dead bottom, and the main reason he gave is he appointed John Marshall Chief Justice of the United States.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Extendivite, a 7-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
It's time for you to have your own custom smartphone app for your business and pay way less than you can imagine. Introducing the I Can Get To Silent Salesman mobile marketing app, a global mobile marketing and communication tool for your business. Go to appsapart.com and learn how you could earn up to $36,351 or more per month just by inviting 2 people or less into a $14.95 per month program. Go to appsapart.com and be sure to watch the video at the top of the site and listen to the audio message from the CEO near the bottom. This is something you won't want to miss. Go to appsapart.com now or call 646-860-9540. That's 646-860-9540. Get the I Can Get To. That's I-C-A-N-G-E-T, the number 2, Silent Salesman app at appsapart.com. That's appsapart.com.
listening to Thomas DiLorenzo talk about what happened to the Constitution. Why don't we just go ahead and play the last two clips straight, and then we'll take calls. You might want to take notes, because he's got an awful lot of information in this talk that he gave, worthy of us trying to remember and trying to make sense of. I mean, this is an amazing amount of history that very few Americans know anything about. Just another example how the victors write history. So let's go ahead and play the rest of it. Okay, Sam?
So the nationalists to this day refer to that as saying, well, it does say we the people, so didn't the Constitution create a government created by the whole people? Well, no, the original version of the Constitution, in the original version, the preamble said this: we the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Providence, Plantations, Connecticut, named all the states individually, until somebody said, well, wait a minute, we don't know that every state is going to ratify. Why? How can we put in the document every state listed? What if Connecticut says, no thanks? They shouldn't be listed in the document. They're not a part of the United States. So they just left it as we the people. That's what actually happened. And it's been lied about ever since. But of course, Madison himself, James Madison, in the Federalist Papers, number 39, explained how the Constitution is to be ratified, not by the whole people. He says, it says this: not as individuals composing one entire nation, but as composing the distinct and independent states to which they respectively belong. And so it doesn't take a lot of searching to find out how the Constitution was ratified. Daniel Webster was another one, a famous nationalist, who carried this argument further. And he, of course, he was in a famous debate over the nature of the Union with Robert Hayne, Senator Robert Hayne of South Carolina, in 1830. And he says this: the Constitution of the United States confers on the government itself the power of deciding ultimately and conclusively upon the extent of its own authority. So could you imagine that the Founding Fathers would have given the government in Washington, it wasn't even Washington, the central government, the exclusive power to decide the limits of its own powers? And of course, they all understood that if they did that, they would soon decide that there are no limits to its powers, which, of course, is where we are now. But that wasn't the original design. This is just a lie.
And do we want to play the next one? Okay. Sounds good. All right. That gives a whole other point of view on what we the people mean. And I've been using that phrase. We've all been using that phrase. Interesting thought. Okay, we'll be right back.
As John Taylor was.
Hey there, quick question for you. Would you be okay with more energy, more endurance, thicker, healthier hair, a better mood, reduced appearance of wrinkles, improved sleep, improved blood pressure and cholesterol profiles, improved vision, improved memory? Okay then. Well now, have you heard of Nature's Youth RSF? It's from the anti-aging experts at naturesyouth.com. Naturesyouth.com. See, at Nature's Youth, they understand exactly what it means to provide top quality health products. And Nature's Youth customers not only improve their health, they know they're also providing their body with the right nourishment to maintain that peak performance and fight the aging process. If health, wellness, and nutrition are what you desire, choose Nature's Youth RSF. I did. You see, you're going to get older. It's just up to you how you feel when you get there. Get started today. Nature's Youth RSF. Simple to use, simple to order. Go to naturesyouth.com. That's naturesyouth.com. Naturesyouth.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.